regulation of home care providers. The sponsor is here, and I think he's prepared to give us a 30-second summary of what House Bill 3 does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we on teleconference?
No.
Okay. House Bill 3, an act relating to public home care providers, restricts the ability of a home care provider to assume power of attorney and requires criminal background checks on any individual providing home care services paid for by public funds for an elderly or disabled person. This bill will provide some protection to elderly and disabled persons from those responsible for their care. These groups are particularly vulnerable to abuse because of age, illness, disability, and the isolation of being home alone with a caregiver. It's important to take these steps now while Alaska is on the brink of an explosion in home care services. Our senior citizen population is rapidly expanding, and the state has just received approval for a Medicaid waiver to provide home and community-based services as an alternative to institutionalization. Once the Medicaid waiver is effective and there is a payment system available for expanded home-based services, the home care services industry will see rapid growth, as it has in other states. This bill also requires background checks on home care providers paid through Older Alaskan Commission grants and respite care providers paid through the Division of Family and Youth Services. An important aspect of this bill is that the Department of Health and Social Services is required to implement regulations identifying actions to be taken upon reports of harm by a home care provider. It also protects the due process rights of the provider. My companion bill, House Bill 4, provides that conviction of a person licensed, certified, or regulated by a board or the Department of Commerce for abuse of an elderly or disabled person may be considered grounds for disciplinary proceedings and sanctions. Mr. Chairman, both of these bills before you today were passed last year by the House and died in the last few minutes of the Senate rules. And I think they're real good bills. I think we know that we're not going to be building a lot of new pioneers' homes or being able to provide, you know, that kind of care. So the home care provider service industry will be rapidly expanding as our senior population, like in the Anchorage, Mat-Su, Kenai Peninsula, and Haines areas, for example, the population in the last 10 years of senior citizens has grown by 108%. So this is a new program now eligible through the Medicaid waiver. And just as a matter of point, public safety tells us that over 30% of all the people they do background checks on do have criminal records. That's when they do background checks for people that are going to be working in daycares or with students, children, those kinds of things. So I think that's a real important aspect.
Yeah, questions of committee members? What's the pleasure of the committee? Senator Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we discharge House Bill 3 from committee with accompanying fiscal notes and with individual recommendations.
Any objection? Okay, HB 3 is moved from committee. House Bill 4.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 4, an act relating to failure to report harm or assaults of the elderly and disabled, will place into state law deterrents to crimes against the elderly and disabled. House Bill 4 will amend the protection of the elderly and disabled adult protection laws to consistently provide a penalty of a Class B misdemeanor for conviction of failure to report a crime under these statutes. It would also require the court to report convictions to an appropriate licensing and regulatory entity. Convictions of a professionally licensed person for a crime against an elderly or disabled person could lead to disciplinary action or sanctions. Elderly and handicapped persons are most vulnerable and disproportionately damaged by crimes against them because they are less able to escape offenders and tend to suffer greater relative deprivation. Additionally, the elderly and disabled take longer to recover from the impacts of financial, emotional, and physical abuse. I'll cut that short and just summarize, Mr. Chairman. These two issues were brought to my attention due to a number of cases that have existed in the state where home care providers, once they've had power of attorney and ability to befriend elderly people, in some instances have ended up spending their life savings and have, you know, control over property. So both of these bills are related to just tightening up and protecting the statutes a little bit more as to it relates to elderly people and home care providers themselves.
Other questions of committee members? Senator Lehman.
Good question, Representative Mackey. Why couldn't these have been done in one bill instead of broken into two?
Through the chair, Senator Lehman, the reason for breaking them out was originally the bill had added an aggravating factor to be used at sentencing. However, further work with the Department of Law, both of these bills have been condensed down substantially from where they were in their original form. Originally, it was necessary for two bills, but because of the reducing the fiscal notes and eliminating some things that may or may not have been controversial, we've ended up with real refined, very simple pieces of legislation that deal directly with the problem.
Other questions, committee members? Yeah, what's the pleasure of the committee? Senator Miller?
Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute for House Bill 4 Judiciary out of committee with, along with accompanying fiscal notes within individual recommendation.
Is there any objection? Not. It was out of committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Matthews. Next bill is House Bill 137, Parole of Terminally Ill Prisoners. I believe the private sponsor is here. Representative Mulder, if you can give us a brief summary of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Emphasis on brief. My name is Representative Eldon Mulder. I represent the Muldoon area in East Anchorage in the State House. HB 137 is a byproduct of the Sentencing Commission's report calling for or recommending that we place within the statutes the allowance for special medical parole for terminally ill patients. It was the belief of the Sentencing Commission and of myself that this would allow the department and the parole board a means or additional tool whereby they could save dollars when evaluating people for parole who heretofore are not eligible, those people being literally those bedridden and sick and on their deathbed, so to speak. In the face of the AIDS problem, the department also felt that this bill was very important. Because as those medical costs are being incurred by the state, or will be, or are being anticipated by the state, there is a fear of what it's going to do to the cost of incarceration. Hence, the department, I worked with the department and produced this bill, and it's passed the House and before you. With that, I would welcome any questions.
Are there questions of committee members? Senator Lehman?
Thanks, Chairman. Representative Mulder. I guess in a technical sense, we all suffer from terminal illness, but just wondered if in all of your hearings and discussions, if there's a restriction on it, isn't it like estimated last year of life or last few months?
Right.
I kind of like to have your understanding of the handle on it.
Right. Through the chair, Senator Lehman, the real question that you're focusing on there is an important one, and that is, what is the definition of terminally ill? And rather than try and be as specific as one might want to be, we left it open because it varies so much. There, you could never anticipate all the circumstances or occasions. It was with that recommendation coming from the parole board to leave it in that form, knowing that they're going to very conservatively, if ever, use this, but only in those instances where they felt that the person being paroled was not a danger to society. That was a restriction or requirement put in there, that this person will not be a danger or a threat to society by being paroled, nor will it diminish the severity of their crime. So it was left rather open.
Further questions? Committee members? Now, it's the pleasure of the committee. Senator Miller?
Mr. Chairman, I move that committee substitute for House Bill 137, Judiciary, out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Are there any objection? Hearing none, the bill is moved.
I'd like to note that made two bills for him today. He got one out of state affairs. I don't know if we should move the next one.
Yeah. actually, we do have an individual who has a time constraint. I'd like to go to House Bill 171. And there's, I believe, one person who's asked to testify. Oh, go ahead. If you're representing the prime sponsor, why don't you go first?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Judy Mathis, staff to Representative Larson. I'd like to thank you for hearing House Bill 171 today. Representative Larson is holding a House Finance Committee meeting at this time and couldn't be here. House Bill 171 would extend coverage of hospice service to Medicaid-eligible adults who do not qualify for Medicare. Hospice care is already a Medicaid-covered service for children and is available to people who qualify for Medicare. Hospice care allows a terminally ill person to receive medical care and psychological, social, and/or spiritual counseling through a single agency, the hospice care provider. Lacking hospice care, an individual may require extensive hospital and/or nursing facility care or have to rely on the sometimes fragmented or piecemeal provision of supportive services in the community. And with that, I have Dave Williams from the Division of Medical Assistance here to answer any questions, and Richie Saunders, a hospice care provider here in Juneau, to answer any questions on the bill.
Okay.
Or she could, she'd like to
testify. My sign sheet says Richie Senator wants to testify.
Yeah,
if you do want
like
to testify,
testify,
please come forward.
Hi.
Please state your name for the record. Please.
I'm Richie Sonner. I'm the Executive Director of Hospice and Home Care of Juneau, and I'm just here in support of House Bill 171. I believe that it's a cost-effective way of treating people who are terminally ill, the hospice method of care. And with that, I would just say that I'm in support of the bill and answer any questions at this time, if anybody has any, about the hospice concept and what it means.
I'll just say that I was questioning, or had my staff question the priority ranking of hospice care, but the department seems to support where it is, so I'll accept that, even though I had a question. Is there any other questions in the committee? Senator Miller.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move committee substitute for House Bill 171, Finance, out of committee with individual recommendation and all accompanying bills.
Okay, is there any objection? Okay, the bill is moved. Back to House Bill 136.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Prime sponsor, state your name for the record.
Again, my name is Elvin Mulder, representing District 23, Muldoon. Thank you for scheduling the bill, Mr. Chairman, and being back so soon. This is an important piece of legislation as well, which is a byproduct of the Sentencing Commission's report. The Commission called for alternative sentencing for individuals convicted of DWIs, but really left open what, in fact, they wanted or desired. Working with the Department of Corrections, Department of Law, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and Department of Public Safety, we crafted 136, whereby those individuals convicted of DWI would serve their time in halfway homes. They would be required to pay for their time also in halfway homes. And while they're in halfway homes, they will be required to serve community service. This is for those individuals convicted of the first and second time. It is estimated that the bill, over time, will save the state a substantial amount of money. It will also diminish the backlog, which we currently are experiencing in relation to people waiting to serve their time. As I understand it, right now we have a 9-month backlog for people trying to serve their time for DWIs. The first part of the bill also restricts the issuance of limited licenses. Currently, individuals convicted of DWI are eligible to apply for a limited license up to your sixth conviction. This has created a real nightmare and a headache for the Department of Public Safety, Division of Motor Vehicles. We are closing that allowance and restricting it down to only after the first DWI are you allowed to make application for a limited license. With that, I would throw it open to questions.
Okay, I have two questions. There is one person from the Department of Public Safety who wishes to testify. One on page 6, line 14. Question the reasoning for having a uniform average cost of imprisonment rather than direct cost, whatever it might be.
The reason for that was we allow within the bill that if they do not have a so-called halfway house or CRC established within a community, the commissioner can make allowance for designating another facility, which is appropriate. The costs throughout the state are going to vary tremendously. As opposed to having one person convicted and paying a certain amount in Bethel and another one paying another amount in Uniclete, another paying another amount in Anchorage, it was determined to be equitable and fair that they'd have an average cost so one person would not pay a greater cost than another who would be convicted to meet that need.
And I have one other question. If you move up one line, it appears twice in the bill, but the last phrase on line 13 says varying levels of restriction. Would you be comfortable if we said that provides a restrictive environment? I can ask the department, but that seems too open for me. If someone's convicted, that was too wide open when I read the bill.
Right. We have no problem with that at all. That language developed in cooperation with the department, and
okay.
I don't think they have a problem with that at all.
Okay, after I hear from Juanita Hensley, I might make that motion. Do you still want to testify?
Basically, Mr. Chairman, I would just be here for questions regarding the limited license motion.
Okay, I would move that on page 6, line 13, and again on page 7, line 13, that we delete the words varying levels of restriction and replace it with the three words, a restrictive environment. Is there any objection to that change?
What, Mr.
Senator Lehman?
Page 7, line...
Same place, on page 7, line 13.
Okay. I don't have any objection.
Okay. What's the pleasure of the committee? Senator Miller?
Mr. Chairman, I would move, actually it would now be a Senate committee substitute for House Bill 136 Hess out of a committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Okay, is there any objection? Hearing none, bills out of committee. House Bill 235.
Thank you.
This is the bug.
Yeah. Is someone here representing the sponsor? Please come forward and state your name for the record. And we are. Why don't you flick your switch on, because in a minute we're going to patch in someone who did want to listen in. Go ahead, you may proceed.
Okay, I'm Myra Howe, State Director of Special Education with the Alaska Department of Education. I would like to point out that Representative Bundy had introduced House Bill 235 at the request of the department. And what I'd like to point out is that I think there's a letter in your packet there that shows what the requirements are as far as coming in compliance with federal laws. Our situation at the department is that we're on a 2-year conditional approval of our stated plan, which we submit to the Federal Department of Education. And this is the last year. After July 1, they will not give us our federal money, which is $8.3 million. 6.9 of that goes out to school districts. The sections that need to be changed to come into federal compliance are Section 8 on the hearing process. It allows for an override procedure when a parent denies consent for initial evaluation or initial placement. Then the school district could go through a hearing process. This is not mandatory. It is permissive. If they believe that the child has rights and needs the services in special education, then they could pursue with the situation with a hearing process. Section 11 and Section 20 deal with consent granted by the parent, stating that it may be withdrawn, and also giving a more precise definition of consent. Section 22 includes rehabilitation counseling, which was added to the list of related services under the reauthorization of the federal bill. And Section 24, which gives a more precise definition of educational records, and also adds two new categories that were under the federal authorization, and that's autism and traumatic brain injury. The other items under that are not federally required under Section 24. In addition, the Senate State Affairs Committee extensively worked on the bill, and we appreciate that. The sections there that were changes made in Section 6, and this regards the independent evaluation. We do have a slight amendment to that we'd like to suggest. Right now, the latest version says independent evaluation by a person of the parent's choosing. We would like to amend that to say from the list provided by the district or by a person selected by agreement between the parent and the school district. The reason for this is that we do require that the school district maintain a list of independent evaluators and provide that to the parent upon request. If the parent disagrees with the evaluation provided by the school district, it would not restrict the parent as far as sticking to that list, but that's the starting point for considering who is qualified and who isn't to provide an independent evaluation. State Affairs also amended, under Section 8, the last part, the department shall maintain a list of qualified hearing officers who have been qualified for a period not to exceed 5 years through a training program. We've had a list of hearing officers. We've never had a 5-year restriction before. We've always qualified them through a training program, so this clarifies that we would be rotating those people. In Section 10 also, there is a provision for an indigent person to have a court-appointed attorney at public expense. And I believe those are the main sections. There were some other amendments made by the State Affairs Committee, but those were the main ones.
Back on Section 18, is that really the heart of the bill here? I mean, is that what's required by federal law? Is that if there is an exceptional child outside of the public school system, that the public school system must provide special ed?
Yes, the public school system in that geographical area where the child is residing must offer the services to that child. If they're in a private school or homeschooled, And it's up to the private school if they want to accept the services or not. The same with the parent. If they're educating them at home, they can accept or reject the services.
Okay. Provide them at the location of the private school, or does
No, that is not required. And in fact, if it's a religious school, you get into difficulties there. The children are usually bused over to the public school for those services.
Okay. Thanks. I'm going to have a couple questions, and maybe we should go through the testimony there. Okay. Are there questions for Myra Howe? No? Okay. Chris Christensen, you wanted to testify?
You're going to ask a question about funding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen, legal counsel to the judicial branch. The court system takes no position on this legislation. However, I am here to request an amendment, which copies of which were submitted to the committee yesterday. One of the changes made by the State Affairs Committee in this legislation is found on page 4, lines 20 through 22, and that was to provide that a person who appeals to the court a determination of the department and who is determined by the court to be an indigent person may apply for court-appointed attorney at public expense. We, of course, take no position on the policy behind providing one additional form of free attorney to indigents. That's a matter for the legislature to determine. The amendment we request, however, would be to make it clear that this function is assigned to the Office of Public Advocacy. When OPA was created back in the mid-80s, all children's matters were assigned to them. They have experts on board who do this all the time. They have long-term contracts with people who are experts in children's law, and they do, in fact, represent indigent parents in several different kinds of cases. The amendment would simply be a change to OPA's jurisdictional statute, which said that they have the duty of providing legal representation to indigent parents under 1430-195. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions for Mr. Christensen? I have a copy of the amendment.
I don't think I have it.
I can check it. The last person who signed up to testify is Mark Grover in Nenana, who wants to testify via teleconference. Mr. Grover, if you can hear me, could you please proceed?
Is that Chairman Lehman? Rieger?
Yes. Go ahead.
Thank you. We have submitted to all the members, I believe, of the HES committee a substantial number of documents, including a proposed committee substitute. House Bill 235 was a bad bill when it was Senate Bill 278. It was a bad bill when it was House Bill 419. It's a bad bill as House Bill 235. We appreciate some of the concerns that was demonstrated in State Affairs.
But
the amendments that State Affairs attached to House Bill 235 do not clearly resolve some concern. I understand that we don't want to end up in big court matters. We don't want to spend a lot of money in the court system. The bottom line is that by the time due process hearings start, it's already too late for mediation, because usually the parents have been involved in fighting the school district for 2 to 5 years when they're finally so fed up that they ask for a due process hearing. What is happening here in this bill is that DOE is trying to do away with parental rights. Parental rights need to be protected. Ms. Howe suggested that this would take place once in a blue moon. I think providing counsel at an appeal level is inappropriate, but the appeal is on the basis of the record. We need to either provide appointed counsel at the hearing level or rely on our existing child protection statutes, which guarantee the hearing before a judge, not some person hired by the school district. Thank you. If there's any questions about what I've offered, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Are there questions of Mr. Grover? Okay. I have a couple of questions in the bill for the department, I believe. Maybe I can call a representative of the department back. First question is, I have about four of these points. Is on the bottom of page 1 on line 14, it says, there's the phrase, have the right to, and I'm always uneasy when the word right is put into statute. Is that phrase required, or could we say shall be provided, or may be provided, or something that avoids that particular phrase?
Mr. Chairman, that wording is not absolutely required. The thing we're trying to get across there is that they don't have to accept it. It has to be offered to them. They don't have to accept the service. If there's another way of wording that, that's fine with us.
I would feel much more comfortable with may be provided. I don't know.
Maybe or shall be.
Well, I'd be more comfortable with may, but I don't know unless there's a legal reason why one or the other has to be put. I think that does at least give the department the flexibility they need if they determine that this is what they have to do. If you don't object, I'll offer that as an amendment. That we, on page 1, line 14, we delete the four words, have the right to, and insert may be provided. Is there any objection?
No.
The next one, let's go to the one that you spoke to. On page 2, lines 17 and 18,
mm-hmm.
You have proposed language which says after choosing, you would add from the list provided by the district, and an alternative would be to delete by a person of the parent's choosing or in its entirety. And I'm just curious which of those two options is better.
What I'm suggesting is by a person of the parent's choosing from the list provided by the department or by a person selected by agreement between the parent and the school district.
Right. In other words, I can see how you might want to have some control over, choosing a person who's unreachable somehow. Some kind of an extreme
mm-hmm.
interpretation
mm-hmm.
of that. But I can see there's two ways to do it. One is to limit the choice by providing a list. The other is to say that the person selected has to be by mutual agreement. And I wonder if you'd testify, or you just answer, which of those two is the better way to go in the department's opinion. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I'm not sure that having to have it by mutual agreement is legal, because this is one area that the school district is allowed to go to a due process hearing on. If the parent selects someone and the district believes that their evaluation is adequate, they can go to due process hearing to prove that their evaluation is adequate, and they therefore don't have to pay for the independent evaluation.
Okay. So you'd stand by your amendment as the way to go. Senator Sala?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question would be, is there any sort of certification or some sort of neutral way to say this is a bona fide place to get an educational evaluation?
Yeah, the requirement is that the evaluator needs to be qualified, which means that they have to have essentially the same qualifications as other people that the district has suggested or is
mm-hmm.
using currently, contracting with, or has on hire. which would be certified or licensed people depending on what's required for that particular field. For physical therapists, for instance, it'd be licensed by the state because they are required to be licensed. So it just depends on what field of evaluation you're looking at.
Continue.
Thank you. Then it seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that the same end could be achieved by saying by a licensed, qualified person of the parent's choosing, because that sort of evaluation of whether they're licensed and qualified would certainly be under the control of the department eventually, I would assume.
It may be occupational licensing, it may be the Department of Education, probably just using the word qualified, because in the federal law, qualified is what is required by the state.
Uh-huh. And if I can butt in, what you're discussing there, the word qualified you feel would be sufficient to address questions where the person is unavailable. If they're unavailable, they'd be unqualified. If the person resides in Miami or something like that.
It probably would not address that, Mr. Chairman. Mm. If there were a way to get at the closest qualified person, I mean, I'm not sure how you would word that, but you know, I think that's what we're getting at, is not to unduly run up the expense for our local school districts, but in the case, as Mr. Grober has pointed out, sometimes there isn't someone very close by that is qualified to do the evaluation. We have in the past had children go down to Seattle because no one in state was qualified. It's especially not uncommon in Southeast, because often that's closer than sending them to Anchorage.
Okay. I guess in listening to this and thinking about it, I guess I'm more comfortable with the amendment you've offered. Is there any discussion on that? I guess. Senator Sabo.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, as a classroom teacher, I've had cause to be involved in a couple of cases that where there was extensive litigation involving special education services. And my feeling is that when you have the circumstance where the parents, for one reason or another, don't trust the district enough to think that the evaluation is correct, they probably also don't trust the district enough to give them the compiled and acceptable list of where else they might go. And that's why I was trying to suggest something that assured the people who were going to pay the bill that we were using a qualified person, but still allow parents at least a greater feeling that they have an independent evaluation. Just to muddy the waters.
No, I follow. It's a tough one.
Yeah. I would propose, Mr. Chairman, just for the purposes of discussion, an amendment which would be on page 2 and line 18, after the word by at the end of the line, that we would add the words and available qualified.
Right after the.
A parent may obtain
18?
On line 17.
17.
Yeah.
By an available qualified person instead of the word a.
Right.
Senator Sharp?
That still doesn't solve the potential distance problem, which has to be borne by the school district. I mean, in my mind, it doesn't. I see, to me, Mr. Chairman, it looks like that option is available in Section 7 already in statute.
You're right.
I mean, if they want an independent at their expense, let them do it. Why hoist that off on the school district? I don't know if they don't agree. Challenge it and get an independent evaluation. That way, if I was the parent, I'd feel more comfortable if I got to pick someone, even if I had to pay for it.
Okay. So, I think that's a good point. I think that's a good point. I think that maybe the amendment offered by the department might be preferable. But I'm willing to discuss Senator Salem. Senator
Miller. Well, just to follow up, although I think I'm tracking Senator Salo, you may have individuals though that cannot afford these independent evaluations, and I have the suspicion that there are not cheap evaluations, and you know, some people, maybe the only way that they can get this independent evaluation is will it be funded by by the district because they can't afford it otherwise. And we do it in a lot of other things where, you know, the state will fund something because one person can afford it but somebody else cannot. You know, I'll fund it for the person that can't afford it because they feel it's something that should be available to them.
Senator Salo and then Sharp.
Okay, good. I have a couple of questions for Senator Sharp, just so that I understand this. What he's saying is they can go and find a person on their own now, who's qualified, available, et cetera. They just have to pay for it. And the department's original amendment sort of controlled, if they were going to pay for it, sort of controlled who they could go to, right? I don't have any problem withdrawing the amendment with that understanding, that the totally independent evaluation is currently available, but in order for it to be that independent, you've got to pay the bill. Otherwise, you have a restricted list to go to. I guess I'm okay with that.
Senator Sharp.
No, I'll just get more involved in 17 and 18 wording, but I'll pass.
Okay. Senator Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Salo said something about a restricted list. We haven't adopted that amendment yet.
No, not yet.
And I'm going to suggest that we not adopt the amendment that was that's offered by the department either. It's my understanding that the department can appeal paying the cost of the independent evaluation anyway, and so it's my opinion this is not even necessary, that we'd leave the list wide open and it's just not even. Am I incorrect in that?
The school district can appeal.
Okay,
yes.
Sorry. School district can appeal anyway.
Who do they appeal to?
Well, they actually request a due process hearing. They notify the parent they're going to due process hearing, hire a hearing officer, go through this whole process. And if they don't agree with the decision of the hearing officer, then they appeal to us for a second opinion. We hire a hearing officer and go through the same process again.
Okay, and they would appeal the cost? Or they could just appeal the cost?
The hearing would be based on whether their evaluation is appropriate. In other words, they would prove that theirs was adequate to start with, therefore the second one they don't have to pay for.
Okay. Senator Sharp.
This is crazy.
Can be obtained at the parent's choosing, a person can be. At the expense of the school district, if the parent disagrees with a previous evaluation, basically, it was already obtained by the school district. Now, if that's in there, why do we, in the world do we need Section 7F? They've already got one chance of selecting on appeal. Why would you need that option down there, then?
Do you have an answer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The second in Section 7 is to deal with if occasionally we have a parent who goes and obtains, maybe they're down south for the summer, someone recommends an evaluation, they get their child evaluated, they come back to the district with the results and say, you know, here's what I found out about my kid, I'd like the program changed. So the school district needs to take that evaluation into account and use that for programming should the parent go ahead and pursue something on their own. They don't have to ask for the school district to pay for that. They might ask for reimbursement if the school district does use that and says your evaluation is more appropriate than the one we have. But usually it's additional information or another point of view.
Senator Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does that mean then that somewhere previous to Section E, or Item E in Section 6, that it says that this parent is appealing a previous decision and has the right to, and that this clarifies the right they have to obtain a separate opinion? Because it looks like to me just what you said they could do under item E and bring it back and have the school district pay for it.
Yeah, we could look it up, but I'd point out that in the bill we have A, C, D, and E right above F, all that same statute. So the only one right here is B, and I'm not sure what B says. Yeah, as I'm saying, if you're curious what the preceding steps to F were, most of them are spelled out, but I don't have to. Senator Sharp.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I'm looking at skeletons that aren't there, but or intentions that are not there. But it seems to me that if a parent was outside, got an opinion from anybody that they chose that they considered an expert, could bring it back and demand payment by the school district court under item E. If they're appealing the school district's school district, as the way I read this, does not have to agree about who the parent chooses in item E. Is that the way you want?
The way it reads right now, I think you are correct. They don't have a choice. They only have the right to appeal the parent's choice. Senator Salo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would assume that accompanying this legislation would be regulations that would spell out a procedure doing this, which would probably, I mean, certainly if I were writing the regs, would require advance approval. You know, the problem that we haven't really discussed here is there are a lot of kind of kooky evaluations that you could get for your child, too, and charlatans, in fact, and mm-hmm. who have sort of been gurus of different approaches for special education. And I've really seen parents who not necessarily spent school district money, but have spent enormous amounts of their own money on approaches that really were never likely to solve the problem of their child. And so I think that's sort of what's of concern to me in Section 7 as well as, you know, you could be out visiting your relatives in California. In fact, most of the charlatans I've heard of are in California. So, and come back with this evaluation and say, and then the school district's obliged to use it in decisions regarding services to the child. I think that's a little worrisome.
Just advice to consider. You can consider and reject, I imagine.
That's true.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, that's true, to consider.
Well, as I read E and F together, and I can see now more how the distinction between the two does involve who pays as much as what the choice is, then mm-hmm. I'm more comfortable going back to the original amendment offered by the department.
Mr. Chair, may I address that issue?
No.
Go ahead.
Thank you. This is Mark Rober again. I think you should know that both E and F track almost word for word federal regulations. The concept behind them is that the district, of course, does their own evaluation. That's how the process is brought about, where the child gets placed or after evaluation. What this does first is it allows the parent to get their own evaluation, and it requires the district to pay, but provides the district with an opportunity to appeal that obligation. The next section simply provides the requirement that the district must consider all the material on the child, because the idea of the multidisciplinary team and the child study team is to make sure that they consider every possible scrap of information that may be helpful in assessing and placing the child. If you limit the parent's choice, then it's not independent, because there's been an a priori determination as to whose evaluations you will get. And I think that you will find yourself in trouble with the federal regulators if you try and limit that choice. Thank you.
Senator Sharp.
Mr. Chairman, it's sort of like someone requesting their whatever a special public defender that they want. You know, I just don't know how far you can go on authorizing freedom of choice on appeal when it's already in item 7, and I realize that it could be expensive. I'm leaning towards closer to the, I don't have a problem with the original wording, but whatever the chairman wishes to do.
I can see, you know, we aren't going to satisfy everyone no matter which way we go, I don't think. But it is in large part a matter of expense. Senator Salem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Has anybody moved this amendment?
No. For discussion purposes.
For discussion purposes, I would like to move the original amendment here at line 18 after choosing add from the list provided by the district.
Okay.
The reason that I wanted to offer that amendment is that I think that that's what makes it like Senator Sharp's example of the public defender. I mean, you know, you are right now have some latitude in requesting which public defender you want, but there is a list. I mean, and that is sort of reined in. And I think this would provide some some assurance that the public money is being well spent.
Okay, the amendment's been moved. Is there any discussion on it? Why don't you call the roll?
Senator Ryder?
Yes.
Senator Sharp?
Yes.
Senator Lehman?
No.
Senator Miller?
No.
Senator Salo?
Yes.
Okay. Three to two, the motion carries. I have another question. On page 3, line 22, if this phrase, actually lines 20 through 22, sounded a little odd to me, that if a parent doesn't participate, the district documents the parent's lack of consent. And I think that I think the wording struck me as odd, and I thought I'd ask about taking the word consent to out of line 22 and replacing it with participation in, because it sounds like that's really all that you can really document is their lack of participation rather than document their state of mind.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I'm the best one to address. Is this was part of the amendments that came out of the State Affairs Committee?
Okay. Well, for discussion purposes, I'll move that. Page 3, line 22, delete consent to and replace with participation in. Senator Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, I understand that wording came directly out of Oregon statutes, and it makes more sense to me to have it the way you've suggested than the way Oregon has.
Okay. Is there any objection to that change? Okay, that's ordered. I'm almost done. I have two left. Page 4 at the top, the phrase on lines 3 and 4 that says, "That shall be open to all residents of the state." Is there anything, is there some freight in that phrase that I'm not aware of, or it just means that anybody can apply and enroll in the program?
Yes, we were keeping that open to anyone. I mean, there would be some qualifications or something, or some screening process undoubtedly, but we didn't want it just, it has in the past been at times limited to just to attorneys on the advice of the Federal Department of Education. They have now changed their stance and believe that we should have lay people as well as attorneys.
This doesn't bear any fiscal implication to the state? They don't have to provide, it's not expensive anything here.
We would be providing the training. We have usually used federal money to provide the training for hearing officers, which we do approximately every 3 years.
Okay.
We have our training, hearing officer training expert from the department here with us. If you have further questions on that topic, I will defer to Ms. Chris Mimi.
No, I think I'm satisfied enough. The last one I had was the new language, page 4, lines 20 through 22. I'm uncomfortable with that, but I know that was something that came up in state affairs, so I just wonder if anyone can speak to that. Senator Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, this was added in the State Affairs Committee. The reason for this is that an indigent will be provided or with an attorney if this someone else brings suit against that person, and this just evens the playing field to provide that if that person appeals to the court, that they will be provided with an attorney. There are others, I believe maybe Mr. Grober was one who testified that attorney should be provided even sooner than the appeal is made to the court, but it was the decision of the committee that was the appropriate time, that we were trying to work out these disagreements out of court before then on a more informal basis, and that this would be a reasonable approach.
The difference that I see, unless I misunderstand it, is that in this case, in the former example, a person has to respond to a court action and has no choice about whether to be in court, but in this case, you initiate the action and then pick up an attorney to accompany you. Is that fair statement?
That's correct, but I think this person has run out of appeals except to the court, and so that's, this is after those other things have taken place, to where the next avenue available is the court, and that person then deserves that representation. Am I understanding correct? Okay.
else have an opinion on this? I'm the only person who doesn't like it.
I'm not saying that I liked it the first time it was presented to me. I asked some of the same questions you did, and then became convinced this I think is reasonable. And then the other that I don't think has come before this committee, but the number of these cases I understand is something like 12 in the last 10 years, and so we're talking about a very small number of cases that we're arguing right now, and I'd certainly like to have that confirmed.
Yes, Ms. Neamey, Mr. Chairman, just put the data together on that this morning, and it appears that there have been 14 hearings and 2 appeals in the last 10 years.
Well, I think I'm going to be outvoted. Just get it on the table. I'm going to move to delete lines 20 through 22 on page 4. And if I'm voted down, that's fine. I just want to express my discomfort with that. If the motion fails, I would intend to take up the court system's proposed amendment to empower them. Is there any discussion?
Did anybody object to that?
Is there any?
I'll object.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Let me take the roll.
Senator Reiner?
Yes.
Senator Sharp?
Yes.
Senator Lehman?
No.
Senator Moore?
No.
Senator Salo?
No.
Okay, the motion fails. We have an amendment from the court system to add a section empowering Office of Public Advocacy to provide the legal representation referenced in 1431-95, which is just what we were working on. I'll move that amendment. Is there any? This is the amendment that the court system wants to make it clear that Office of Public Advocacy is the person to be providing the indigent representation.
I saw it earlier.
Here, anyone who wants that.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Okay.
Is there any objection, Senator Lehman?
I'm just going to just ask. I read this to say that, and I don't have AS 4421410, but I read this just to add a 10th item to the things that can be done by the Office of Public Advocacy, and it says that they have to provide that representation, but this now authorizes them to be able to. Is that correct?
Shall. The statute says shall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, the statute, it says the powers and duties and the Office of Public Advocacy shall, and then it lists the first 9, and that would be the 10. And then the statutes are connected with the original backup.
Senator Sharp.
Mr. Chairman, I don't see why we have any choice. By failure to delete Section E, I think we about have to add that. And I would ask that prior to the finance meeting, that we have a fiscal note reflecting what that estimated cost would be by adding mandatory representation.
I'll make sure that we request that. Staff says that one has tentatively been provided already. Senator Salo.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, from the figures that we have on the number of cases and appeals, and then the use of this section, I mean, it's likely that this isn't going to add anything or not much potentially in the fiscal note. But I just want to point out that I think the Office of Public Advocacy was an area in the budget that had a major big hit. And so, I mean, if there is a fiscal note on this, I would ask that it be taken into consideration. Thank you.
Is there any other discussion on House Bill? Let's see. All right, we haven't voted on this yet. This is offered. Is there any objection to the court system's requested amendment? Okay. It's considered to be in the bill then. Is there anything else on 235? What's the pleasure of the committee? Senator Salem.
Thank you. I do have another question. On the top of page 5, given the amendment that we made about the list from which you choose, I'm wondering if there's a necessity, and I don't know the answer to this question, I'm asking is there a necessity to change that language to conform? Because again, it talks about the selection of a another evaluator, so I don't know quite how you do it. In fact, in reading this, it looks like that. I mean, there's two methods by which a parent might choose an independent evaluation. And I'd like to hear the department's opinion at least on this.
Senator Zala, it seems clear that this would be a conforming amendment. This is just to inform an individual of the provisions that we've just written on the prior page. So I think you're correct. This same amendment would apply or should be offered for page 5, line 2.
After the word choosing?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I believe you're correct in that interpretation.
Okay.
Then I would offer that amendment.
Okay. Is there any objection to that amendment?
Is that the same amendment I objected to before?
Yeah.
Well, I'll object again.
Okay.
Let me be consistent.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Let's take a vote again.
Senator Roger?
Yes.
Senator Sharp?
Is this going on again?
Yeah.
Yes.
Senator Lehman?
No.
Senator Miller?
No.
And Senator Salo?
Yes.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lehman?
And I just want to note that we have a fiscal note from the Office of Public Advocacy, a zero fiscal note dated 4/20/93, and albeit before this amendment that Mr. Christensen suggested, maybe they did not presume that they would be the ones providing that legal service. I don't know what the what they presumed, but it is a zero fiscal note that's coming right now, and we may want to just ask them to reflect on that fiscal note in light of what we did today.
I think that'd be a good idea. I'll ask staff to please check. Is there anything else on House Bill 235? It's the pleasure of the committee. Senator Salem?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate House Committee send out the Senate's CS for HB 235, special education bill with individual recommendation.
Okay, and accompanying fiscal notes, yes. There's any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, that's all the business come before us. We're adjourned.
I understand the open is the fiscal note, knowing that they'd be the ones doing the representation. If you choose to check and confirm that again,
okay.